The date is May 22nd, 1990, and I am speaking with my uncle, William Manifold, from Michigan, who is in town for my wedding on Friday. Can you just state your name and when and where you were born?
My name is Bill Manifold. I was born in Chicago, Illinois, July 2nd, 1921.
And in front of Uncle Bill, I have a lot of the documents and photographs which he gave me several years ago concerning his service in the Second World War. First, I'd like to talk about, you had told me just a half an hour or so ago that you wanted to enter the Air Corps as opposed to the infantry. Can you expand on that a little bit? Well, first of all, where were you when the war broke out?
I was in Chicago. I was working at Bauer and Black, at a surgical dressing company. My first job. I was working in a warehouse as a shipping clerk. I was just barely old enough to go into service at the time.
Mm-hmm. The age for a volunteer was, would it have been 21?
I think it was 21.
21.
I always wanted to fly, and I had little experience in a Piper Cub just previous to joining up. But I don't know whether it was the glory or what, but I didn't want to be an infantryman, slouching through the mud and stuff. So I enlisted and figured that they were going to draft me anyway, so I might as well enlist and try to get a choice of what I wanted.
What was your attitudes towards the war at the beginning? Were you caught up in the patriotic fervor?
Well, yeah, I was always patriotic and idealistic. I was a blood donor. I gave to the Red Cross. And at that age, you had a lot of ideals, and you wanted to prove to the world that you wanted to turn the world around, practically, because of all the things that were going on at that time. Now they seem mild, but at that time you do.
Mm-hmm. Your previous flying lessons, were you self-taught, or how did you come about the Piper Cub? Had you owned this airplane,
or no,
did you just rent it?
No, I just went to a flying school at the local airport and signed up for some lessons. And my instructor was Opal Anderson. She was I think Lester was her married name. And went through all the basic instructions and learned all the climbs and glides and turns and mm-hmm. all that.
Yeah, we have a copy of your pilot log here, and you can verify some of the... So you had relatively few hours before you were...
I only had 9 hours in a Piper Cub.
Before. 9 hours in a Piper Cub before you mm-hmm. entered the Army Air Corps.
It was a Cub J-3 with a Lycoming engine.
So had you made any solo flights at this time, or did you have enough?
No, after I had my training, then I soloed.
Mm-hmm. And where was the first, when you first entered the service, what was the first place you went?
I went in as a private, I think it was Camp McCoy, Wisconsin.
That would have been for 9 weeks of basic training.
Yeah, basic. I may be wrong though now, because I went in with Civilian Conservation Corps training too, and that might have been where I went mm-hmm. for that.
Well, that's not important. What type of aircraft did you train in at first for the most basic?
Well, before I started flying, I had my basic military training. From that, I went from private to an aviation cadet. And then from there, I went through primary training, basic training, advanced, and then into the military aircraft after that.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any preference to what kind of aircraft or that you wanted to
pilot? Yeah, I did, but didn't work out that way. I wanted to be, well, I guess almost everybody like wanted to be a fighter pilot, you know, because it's a lot more glamorous and more action. I wanted to be a P-38 pilot. But after I had all my training, then they found that they had enough fighter pilots and they needed bomber pilots, so the colonel called me in the office and says, we need volunteers, and you, and you're assigned to four-engine bomber training. That's when I got into bombers. But after I was in there a while, then I was kind of glad of it, because of the fighter, you only had one engine, and if you got shot out, you were out of luck. But with the B-17, you had four engines, and you could shoot out one, two, even three, and you could still limp back.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any close calls during your years of training?
I had a few, and when I was learning to fly a B-25, I was practicing takeoffs and landings. And I came in on one landing, and our landing speed, I think, was approximately 125 miles an hour, something like that. And you can run out of runway pretty fast at that speed. So I had made the touchdown, and I was leaning over and started grabbing the emergency handle for hydraulic pump, and I started pumping away. And the instructor said, what are you doing? And I said, I don't have any brakes, I'm pumping up the hydraulic pressure. And he says, you handle the controls, I'll take care of the pumping. So he pumped, and we brought her down and slowed her down. Everything turned out okay, but it was just something that happens. It's your training prepares you for things like that. And he says, boy, I'm glad you were on the ball, because we would have found out a stick somewhere off the end of the runway.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever run into any type of foul weather that caused any problems?
Yeah, I had a crazy experiment on my first solo cross-country flight.
Now, excuse me, when you say cross-country, you literally flew across the United States?
Not across the whole, just from our...
From one point to it, like from one base to
base
another.
Maybe to another state.
Okay, but they called it cross-country, even though you literally didn't go across the entire country.
Not the entire country, just cross-country.
Okay.
Like, say you were flying from Chicago to Milwaukee, that would be cross-country.
Right. I just wanted to clarify that.
I think it was in basic training. And it was a night flight, and I was out for maybe half an hour. And as you're flying, you'd have to check your towns by the lights and that on your way, so you'd keep your bearings straight. And all of a sudden, I see these lights coming at me, a red and a green light, and I thought, holy mackerel, where'd he come from? And I ripped. Turned that thing up on a wing and avoided head-on collision, which I thought. Then after I straightened out, then I realized it was my own lights reflecting on a cloud.
Oh, no. But you thought it was another plane coming at you.
It looked exactly like another plane coming at me.
Well, in these early... Now, were you in a training aircraft at this time, or were you in the actual bomber?
No, that was during training.
During training. Did you have any type of radar in the plane?
Oh, no.
No, so it was all by sight only? You had to... there was landmarks on the
ground? Sight and instruments, but in those days, they weren't as sophisticated as they are now.
Mm-hmm.
We had a magnetic compass and turn and glide indicators and... altimeter, that's about it.
Any other special memories you have of training? Was it an enjoyable experience or was it tough?
Both. There were times when felt like quitting, actually, because it was a tough routine, because you started maybe 5 o'clock in the morning and you'd go till late at night.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they had to cram a lot of information into your training because they had a short time to get you over there in fighting.
Right.
And in my case, I had double work because I had only had a year and a half of high school, and then I had to get out and help support the family. And I wasn't even sure I could make it because of not having any education. So I was going to night school to learn things that I should have had in high school that I didn't. And I was competing with college graduates in some things. And fortunately, I had some good instructors that went along with me and helped me. And it made me kind of proud and happy that some of these college graduates washed out and I made it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of a thrill.
What kind of things did you do for entertainment? Was there were there movie houses on the base?
Oh, yeah. Or? Practically every base had a movie theater, PX. Practically everybody hung out at the PX.
Mm-hmm.
Usually they had a little bar there with a 3.2 beer. But I wasn't much for drinking. I think I saw just about every movie that came out. And
did you have any favorite movies or any favorite movie stars that you liked?
Not really. I liked any movie, just most anyone.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get a chance to go back home while you were at basic training? And if so, how did you get home? Did you hitchhike or?
No, usually took trains in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Or a bus sometimes, depending on the distance. Yeah, we had usually had a maybe a 10-day leave between each camp.
Mm-hmm. But if you ever wanted to go into town, did you ever hitchhike? And?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Never had any problem with anyone stopping to pick you up?
No, back in those days, people were pretty proud of their servicemen, and they knew the situation that we were away from home and didn't have transportation. They were pretty good about picking you up. But we did have some places that had buses, shuttle service from camp to town.
Mm-hmm.
We had one that was a semi with a flatbed on the back, and they rigged seats on it, and that was their bus.
Cheap bus, huh? Did you have any special instructions if you were ever shot down? Instructions on what to say, what to destroy? You gave me your map that has, I guess it's kind of a waterproof fabric type of thing.
Yeah,
aside from that,
I think it was on silk, and it was rubberized silk.
Aside from that, did you have any other special gear to carry on you in case you were shot down?
Yeah, we had a packet that was issued to us depending on what our target was. If we were going for Germany or different places, we might have a packet with a map of the terrain of that area, plus Deutschmarks and money that we could spend if we were picked up.
Mm-hmm.
We had a fake ID. We had our photos taken in civilian clothes with crazy hats and things to make us look like we were part of the local people.
But you didn't receive any language instructions?
No, we didn't have time for that.
Mm-hmm. So then you went over to England with the 8th Air Force?
Yeah.
How did you get to England? Was it by...
We flew a B-17 over.
Was it a direct flight, or did you go by way of Iceland, or...
We flew up to Gooseberry, Labrador. Landed there, it was 25 below zero. And I think they had about 25 feet of snow, and that was just packed solid, so that was the runway.
Mm-hmm.
And the buildings and that had drifts up to the rooftops all around. And When we landed there, I think it was 2 in the morning or something, and of course we were tired and hungry, and they took us in the mess hall and gave us something to eat, and that was our first trial or whatever, the first time we were introduced to K rations and that type of food. We had, they said it was butter, but it tasted more like lard.
Probably was.
And then we stayed there overnight, took off the next morning, and they had to put hoods over each engine overnight, and then they had a heater that they would heat the engine up with, because it wouldn't even 25 below.
To keep the fluid from freezing in the lungs.
The oil would thicken, and you couldn't even turn them over. Mm-hmm. So then we were assigned to a B-17, and we flew from there across to Ireland and landed near Dublin. We were put up there in a Quonset hut, and that was about the coldest place I ever slept in. It was a metal building, and they had a potbelly stove there, but nothing there to use for fuel, because everybody ahead of us had used up the supply, and of course there was a war on, so everything was rationed and short supply. Mm-hmm.
Now, when you flew these to your bases, were the machine guns in them and that kind of thing, or were they added after the plane got to their bases?
I think we had armament on them when we brought mm-hmm. them over. Yeah, I think because that was part of the program, was to get them over there.
Mm-hmm. But then something like the Norden bomb site would have been added afterwards.
Probably.
Because it was such a highly classified... About the airplane itself, how was it to fly it? Was it an easy plane to fly, or...?
Fairly easy. It was... it had manual trim tabs on it, so you could set it up so that the controls operated with the least resistance. And, of course, it wasn't like flying a Piper Cub or a fighter or anything. It was more like driving a compact car, and this was a truck.
Mm-hmm.
You had 4 engines and a lot more power and a lot more plane.
Did you have a form of automatic pilot that you could turn on?
Mm-hmm.
I've just handed him a copy of the checklist which he gave me. It says the B-17E version. Did that not have the chin turret or the ball turret, or what version was the E? Was that one of the later ones?
That was a later one. It probably had the chin turret in it. I'm not sure, but it probably did.
Mm-hmm. So there was quite a... Before you started the plane up on a mission, you had to go through this entire checklist and make sure everything was in working order?
Right. The co-pilot would read off the checklist to the pilot. The pilot would go through the routine of setting the controls and switches and everything, and repeat whatever the co-pilot called out. He would say switch on or flap set or whatever it was. Mm-hmm.
It was custom for a lot of the pilots to paint things on the side of their aircraft. Did your plane have anything painted on it?
Not when we brought them over. That was done later.
Right. But later, did your plane have anything painted on it? Like a girl or a cartoon character or...
Trying to remember if we got that far. I don't think so, because we didn't have any missions to chalk up.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't have anything painted on your leather jacket or anything? Unit number?
Insignia. Mm-hmm. Insignia.
You had the Army Air Corps patch on your sleeve?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lost track here. A lot of the other planes all had cartoon characters and pretty gals and stuff on their planes, and then they would put little bombs for their bombing raids and little planes that indicated they shot so many planes down. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the fellas later were interned over in Sweden, and I was kind of into crafts and that, so I painted a lot of insignia on their jackets while I was there.
Oh, really? Do you remember what the favorite theme was? Was it mostly girlfriends, or when they were painting their jackets? What was the more popular themes?
Bugs Bunny was one of the most popular ones.
Really?
and some of them had girls, but they kind of shied away from that because they couldn't show favoritism. You couldn't put one fellow's girlfriend on and not another.
Right.
So that it would go more toward just bare bosoms and things. Mm-hmm. That were spectacular.
Where in England were you stationed?
Thetford. I think it was, I'm just guessing, maybe 50 miles from London. Mm-hmm. And during the night we could go out and watch. We could hear the Germans coming on those bombing raids, and we'd go out and watch, and we could hear the planes, and then we could see the flashes over London as they were bombing the city. But it was an interesting experience too, because some of the ones that had been there longer, and say they had been on 20 missions or so, and they were getting kind of war weary, and some of them, they'd get flak happy, at least that's what the term they used. Be in the barracks and they'd pull out their .45 and start shooting up the place, and just because they were...
It was the sound, it was the loud noises that upset them, or did they just crack?
Yeah, some of them just flipped their wigs, they just go berserk. It might be that they were having nightmares or something, and they'd wake up and think they were shooting at the enemy, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But usually with those type, they would send them back home and give them R&R. Of course, they'd go through psychiatric testing before they'd send them home, just to make sure they weren't goofing off.
Right, they weren't doing it on purpose.
But while we were in England, they had what they called biscuits. We didn't have mattresses on our bunks. There were three-section biscuits. They were small mattresses, but the climate over there was terrible. It was humid and cloudy all the time, I think. I think I saw the sun about 20 minutes out of the 3 months I was there. But you were so darn tired that you just crawl in between these biscuits and conk out. And then sometimes they'd blow the air raid siren, and we were supposed to head for a bomb shelter because there might be a Ju-88 or something come in and dive bomb in the field.
Did you ever have that happen while you were there?
Oh, yeah. but then you just got so tired that you said, oh, the hell with it. And you just lay there and figure, if my time is up, it's up. So,
Were the air bases protected by anti-aircraft guns, a lot of them?
They had a lot of air raid wardens all over England on rooftops and all over the place. And they had, I have no idea how many or where they were located or anything, because I was just more or less interested in the flying end of it. But they had anti-aircraft all over the place.
About your missions, what did the mission briefing consist of, and how long did it last? And when did you find out which target you were going to be?
The morning that you would take off, you would find out that you'd get up early in the wee hours, and you'd go into this Quonset hut, and they had a big map in the, up in the front there, and the commander or whoever happened to be on charge would have a pointer, and he'd point to the map and say, this is your target for today, and he'd explain the route we were going to use, the altitude, what unit you'd be flying with, and get all the details. Then everybody would head for their planes and take off. And then there might be 50 planes going on this one mission, so the first ones would have to take off, keep circling around the field and round until the others would come up and tack on, until you had a full attack group. Then when you got all assembled, then you'd take off for your target.
At this time, did you have the long-range fighters to escort you, or were you on your own after you crossed over France?
We'd have short-range mostly, but we didn't have too many long-range in those days. But
The Mustangs weren't there yet. The P-51s were not in England yet at the time?
They were there, but they couldn't fly too far because their supply wasn't as... They didn't have as big a gas supply as we did.
What was to be the target of your first mission?
I don't remember my first mission because we took off and headed out. And we ran into bad weather and a lot of clouds and that, so our formation dispersed and we all headed back to the base. And after that, when we decided we were going on a mission, we thought we didn't get any credit for that one, so we decided next one, no matter what comes, we're going to get credit for it. So the second one was a doozy. That was ball bearing factory at Posen, Poland.
Posen, P-O-S-E-N?
We call it P-O-S-E-N, Posen. But their spelling was P-O-Z-N-A-N. And we had to take a roundabout route. We went up north and then cut across and then cut back across the coast of Posen to the factory. And, of course, as soon as we crossed the coast, all these anti-aircraft started firing at us. And, our schedule was to fly over, hit our target, and then because we had gone more than halfway on our fuel supply, we couldn't turn back. We had to go over to Russia, who was an ally at that time, and we were to land there and then refuel. But the flak was so heavy that on that mission that although we hit our target and knocked it out, very few of the planes that were on that mission made it paid it back. A lot of them were shot down. A lot of them, I don't know how many made it to Russia, but our plane was hit so bad that not sure whether it knocked out one or two of our engines. So we figured our best bet would be to head for Sweden. And we headed up that way, but at that time Denmark and Norway were under Nazi control, so we didn't want to land in those. And we wished we had paid more attention to the country's flag colors, because we could see their flags flying down below, but we weren't sure whether we were in Sweden or one of the others. And I had that previous Piper Cub training, which helped me. I spotted a small field, and we flew over and circled and looked it over, and then we could see him, what we thought was shooting at us. And we thought, uh-oh, this is Denmark. But we thought, well, we're almost out of fuel. We got to land somewhere. It was either that or ditch, and we didn't feel like ditching in the water. So we put down the full flaps and set her down, and we just about ran out of field when we just got it stopped. And a whole bunch of soldiers came running out with rifles and machine guns and everything. We thought, uh-oh, Denmark. And they pointed these guns at us and motioned us and over toward their headquarters building. And we walked in this headquarters. The officer in charge says, "Welcome to Sweden." What a relief.
Did the soldiers know that you were, who you were?
Oh, I think they did, sure. Because they all knew it. I think they called it Fugandi Fastning. It was a B-17. And we landed at Kalmar, which was a small town on the southern end, I think, of Sweden. And they brought us to a hotel there, and we were the first B-17 flyers they had ever seen. So they put us up in this hotel, and we were like kings or movie stars or whatever. They had a balcony out in the hotel, and a crowd had gathered outside, and they had heard about it. And we went out on this balcony, and we were waving, and it was just like you were a movie star. And then we had a smorgasbord, and they had everything under the sun. They had eel and bear and fish and meatballs and you name it, they had it. And of course, never having had any before, we had to sample everything. And boy, what a meal. And then they kept playing us with schnapps. We weren't used to that either.
You told me that photographs 73 and 74 were taken while you were in Sweden. Do you remember the circumstances under which?
Yeah.
Either one of those?
After we spent a day or so at this Kalmar, they didn't have facilities there to put us up. They took pictures of us out on this balcony, and we made the front page of the local paper. And then they put us on a train and shipped us up further north. We went to Stockholm, and then from there we were transferred to a little village called Rättvik. And there we were given an allowance. We went to local stores and bought civilian clothes, and we lived in what we would call a motel over here. It was a tourist hotel, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're about halfway. We got about 30 more minutes on this side.
Oh.
So you were at this hotel sort of thing in Stockholm.
The Thunberg's tourist hotel. I think there was maybe 30 of our GIs that were living in this place, and it was a good deal because we got our military pay while we were there. We were free to go around the country. I bought myself a bicycle for transportation, and I learned to speak Swedish, not fluently, but enough to get by.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher was a refugee from Denmark, so she said. And about 2 or 3 weeks after we had signed up for her class, this military intelligence came around and were asking us about her and asking what information we had given her and that. And I said, personally, I got more information from her than she did from me. And we found out that she was a German spy.
Really?
Yeah.
At this time, what did you do with your flying clothes? Had you destroyed them? Or you had said something about buying
your civilian clothes. And I kind of think they probably were packed and shipped back to the American Embassy or something like mm-hmm. that. I'm not sure. But when we had these clothes and toured around, I even bought a camera, and I had a problem with it, and it had to be sent back to the factory. At the time, I didn't think of it, but the factory was in Germany. I sent a camera, American pilots, and sent a camera back to Germany to be repaired. And fortunately, nothing happened. I got it back.
So then how long did you spend in Sweden?
I was there 6 months.
6 months.
Yeah. Met a lot of Swedes. That's one reason I wanted to learn Swedish, because I palled around with a fellow I met there at the local hardware, and two or three of them. And then there was a gal that worked there too, and I started dating her, and we went to movies, and they used to have what they called a Volksgarten, and they had a dance every Saturday night, I guess it was, and we used to go there and dance the Swedish, Scottish, and of course they did a lot of American dancing too. It was quite an experience.
Then how did you get back from, you went from Sweden back to England?
Yeah.
By boat, or did you fly?
No, we had to wait for bad weather to fly out. They, because of the war going on, they didn't want us flying out in good weather. We'd be easy picking. So that was my first flight in a B-24. And I didn't care much about it. I forget how many must have been 40 or 50 of us packed in the back end of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was cold and noisy, but we made it.
Do you remember the names of any of your fellow crewmen?
Yeah, Irving Abramowitz. Can't remember his first name. Neely. He was a radio man. Jan Begg, our bombardier. Wally Buckley was our navigator. Pappy Sorensen. And Price, I can't remember his first name. And who else? I can see his picture, but I can't think of his name. I still correspond with him at Christmas time. We get a card from each other.
Oh, really?
I have three that I still correspond with from the service.
Mm-hmm. Were these three that were on the plane at the time, or just this one?
Over the years, I lost track with most of them, but our bombardier, I still correspond with him.
Mm-hmm.
And, I can't think of his name.
Oh, that's okay.
But I still write to him.
Mm-hmm. While you were over your target during the second mission, what exactly was flak like? Could you see it, the cannons actually?
You could look down and you could see them, flashes of smoke as they fired them down below.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could look out the windshield and you could see puffs of black smoke all around. They really had us on target. Their range was very good.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see these puffs of black smoke, and then as they got closer, you could hear them, and it sounded like
mm-hmm.
somebody slapping their hands together. It was a loud boom. And we could see planes out on our sides getting flak hits. One not too far away from us took a direct hit right in the bomb bay, and we watched him go down in flames. And,
what was your reaction seeing something like that, or just being in a barrage? Were you so busy flying that you
didn't have time to think about it? You were so busy doing your job.
Mm-hmm. Was it? Were you tense or?
Oh, I imagine I was. You don't really think about it. That's all part of your training. You're trained to do your job regardless of what your circumstances are, and that's what
mm-hmm.
you do.
Anything else about the mission that you can?
I'm trying to think of
anything that we haven't covered. That
well, when we got down in Sweden, we had a chance to look the plane over the next day and see the extent of the damage. And man, I don't know how our tail gunner ever got out, because there was flak holes about every 9 inches on that tail.
Really?
I don't know how he ever survived, but none of us on the crew was injured.
Hmm.
The plane was a mess, but the crew was safe.
Did you wear the flak vests, those heavy armored, or was that mostly for the waist gunners?
No, we had flak vests, and we also had flak under the seats of the pilot and co-pilot.
Special
armor
plating underneath the seats.
Get us up then.
Did you wear your parachute, or did you have yours stowed? You wore them?
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever, in your training...
That was part of your seat, actually.
Uh-huh. So when you wanted to bail out, you had to unsnap something, or you just stood up and your chute came?
Stood up and headed for the trap door behind us. And
mm-hmm. In your training, did you ever have to parachute out of a...
No, the only parachute jumps I ever made were on a practice tower.
Mm-hmm.
I never...
You were attached to a harness? And
yeah, we had a guy wire. We'd climb up on a big platform, and then you'd jump, and we were in a regular parachute harness, but we didn't have a chute. It was just the cords going up from the pack to the chute,
mm-hmm.
and that they would be attached to a cable, and you'd get the sensation of parachuting, but you wouldn't actually be parachuting.
Right. So you, after your 6 months in Sweden, you returned to England?
Yeah.
And how long did you spend there before?
We weren't there too long, and then they shipped us back for R&R, relaxation and recreation, I think it was called.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sent back to Miami, Florida. Stayed in fancy motels down there, and
mm-hmm.
it was something really fantastic, because we didn't expect some of the fellows that had been on a lot of missions, they deserved it, but with us, we took advantage of it though, as long as we were there.
Was that common practice for crews that had been shot down and managed to make it back? They were sent back home?
Evidently, yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess it was for all crews.
Uh-huh. Then what happened after your stay in Florida? Is this when you went down to Tucson?
From Florida, I went for reassignment, and I went to Randolph Field in San Antonio, Texas, and went through the course for single engine instructor. I finished the course, and I didn't actually want to be an instructor because they wanted to send me back to Arizona to teach Chinese to fly, and I, after coming back from overseas and safe, I didn't feel like I wanted to get killed over here by some crazy chink that would freeze on the controls or something. So then I asked for a transfer to somewhere else. I wanted to get in photography because I was interested in that, so fortunately they had an opening out with Marana, and that's mm-hmm. when I got out there.
So you were in charge of the photo lab, or?
Yeah, it was a combination photography lab. It was kind of an L-shaped building, and the photo lab was in one part, and then the other part was the publications department. It was a warehousing for all the typing forms and requisitions and everything they used on the base. We had a crew of maybe 15 to 20 people there. I was the first lieutenant at the time, and I was in charge of the unit, and there was a warrant officer under me, and I gave him the job of taking care of the publications part, because I was more interested in photography. Of course, I still maintained my flight status, and I had to get in so many hours a month to keep my rating active,
mm-hmm.
which was easy enough to do, because if we had crashes out in the desert, I'd have to fly out there and take pictures, and that brings back a memory there too. We flew out to another field one time. Sergeant Rikas was with me. He was my staff sergeant in charge of the enlisted personnel.
Mm-hmm.
And I came in for a landing, and suddenly it dawned on me I hadn't put my flaps down. And so I was coming in on the final approach. It was darn near down. I threw down my full flaps, and That was a mistake.
What happened?
It changed the contour of the airfoil, and all of a sudden there was like an elevator. I was going down fast.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I had enough training and sense that I knew how to react, and I got on the throttle and gave it more power and just leveled out in time to get on the runway before we were just going down like shoo. It scared the heck out of the sergeant because he said, "Boy, I don't want to fly with you anymore."
This would have been a...
I never did admit to him. I was scared too. This was the first time that had ever happened.
This would have been a twin-seater trainer?
That was an AT-6.
AT-6.
That was an advanced trainer.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever go to any of the shows at the little canteen they had there at...
Yeah, they had...
Do you remember
USO it? Shows and things like that.
Were there any Hollywood celebrities that came out that
yeah,
you saw?
Bob Hope was one of them, and the Camel cigarette company used to sponsor shows. And then, of course, they passed out free samples to all the GIs.
But that was popular.
But the guys were always interested in the dancing gals and that,
mm-hmm.
and the skimpy costumes after being overseas. But they also had jugglers and magicians and all kinds of mm-hmm. different acts.
There you go. Here's a picture of you and Sergeant Rikas.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this is photograph number 63. Now, is that a prop cigar, or is that a real?
No, that was a...
That was a prop.
It was a real cigar, but it was just a novelty. I forget the occasion. It might have been his birthday or something, and somebody mm-hmm. just gave it to him. He always smoked regular cigars.
Uh-huh. So was this in your office, or...
Yes, that was my office. Mm-hmm.
Now, were there things that you could not photograph, for instance, types of aircraft, or if you did you have to stamp them?
No, I was in charge of photography, so I could take whatever I thought of. Most of the time, the commanding officer or somebody from the flight line or whatever needed photographs, they would get in touch with me, and,
mm-hmm.
and we would fill a request. A lot of times we'd have visiting dignitaries or whatever the occasion was, then we'd send a photographer, either myself or Sergeant Rikas or a couple of the others would go out on assignment.
Then you had your own dark room and everything where you could develop your own photographs.
We didn't do any color work, which was all black and white in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a refrigerator there that we kept our film in, so it was kept at a reasonable temperature because out in the desert there, your mm-hmm. film wouldn't last too long.
Now, the majority of the negatives and photographs which you gave me, these were already at the base when it closed down. Explain how you got all of these photographs and negatives.
Well, over the years, all these were kept in a file, and a lot of them were there before I took over, because mm-hmm. others had been in charge before I got there. But when the camp disbanded, we were ordered to destroy everything, and to me it was a terrible waste to see good typewriters and desks and everything, just take them out in the middle of the desert and put them on a big pile and torch them.
Really?
I asked why they couldn't sell them to the GIs at a good discount. And
mm-hmm.
they said they didn't want to interfere with the civilian market. But fortunately, being a collector all my life and a scrounger, I just figured I'm not going to get rid of all these pictures and photographs, and I'll take a bunch of them home with me for souvenirs, if nothing else. Now I'm glad I did.
Would you have been in trouble if you had been caught with these?
At that time, I probably could have. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether now it would make any difference. But, you know, back in those days, I probably could have been court-martialed for disobeying an order.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to pause here for a minute. At this point, I'm going to stop the tape and turn it over to the other side.